in the limelight. Increasing numbers of children are going hungry in the United States as it weathers the world's worst coronavirus outbreak, which has killed around 280,000 people and caused a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. According to the Commerce Department, nearly 12% of adults said that they lived in a household where there was not enough to eat, sometimes, or often last month. A Brookings Institution survey found 10% of mothers reported their children under the age of 5 went hungry to some degree in October and November. Non-profit Feeding America estimates over 50 million Americans will be considered food insecure this year, including about 1 in 4 children, reversing gains made in recent years that had brought hunger among children to its lowest level in at least 2 decades. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Pandemic Sends Hunger Rising in U.S. and Children Bear the Brunt. Please stay with us for more of the Associated Press article. Before the coronavirus pandemic closed her middle school and U.S. immigration agents deported her father to El Salvador, Kimberly Orellana did not fear going hungry. But with her mother now alone and cleaning houses for pay that isn't enough to reliably feed Orellana and her 2 younger sisters, the 14-year-old is left to trek to a nearby school for a handout of groceries organized by a non-profit organization. As she ran the errand north of Baltimore on a cold and rainy morning during a break from classes, which are now held online, Orellana said, "Everyone in our family eats. Sometimes we need a little bit of groceries to keep our fridge full." Increasing numbers of children are going hungry in the United States as it weathers the world's worst coronavirus outbreak, which has killed around 280,000 Americans and caused a once-in-a-generation economic crisis. According to the U.S. Commerce Department, nearly 12% of adults said they lived in a household where there was not enough to eat sometimes or often last month. A Brookings Institution survey found 10% of mothers reported their children under the age of 5 went hungry to some degree during October and November. Non-profit organization Feeding America estimates over 50 million Americans will be considered food insecure this year, including about 1 in 4 children, reversing gains made in recent years that had brought hunger among children to its lowest level in at least 2 decades. Lauren Bauer, an economic studies fellow at Brookings Institution, told Agence France-Presse, "We feel pretty confident in saying food insecurity right now is the highest on record in the modern era." The numbers are jarring for a country that has the purported world's largest economy, and its officials wrongly claim the country is a major donor of food aid worldwide. Chloe Waterman, a program manager for advocacy group Friends of the Earth, said food and agriculture is about 20% of the U.S. economy and 100% of people are eaters. The pandemic's March arrival and the business shutdown that followed brought soaring unemployment and a sharp contraction in economic growth. President Donald Trump's downplaying of the coronavirus and U.S. states' uneven response set the stage for ongoing surge in the number of cases and deaths. Schools also shut down, making it complicated for poorer children to get free meals at schools. And Lauren Bauer said, runs a grocery store created a shortage of basic goods that put low-income parents further behind. Lauren Bauer added, the pressure on families to pay for some of those things that that the public provides was quite disastrous. Congress responded by allowing states to give families whose children would normally get school meals benefit cards equal to their value, while many school districts also continued providing food that students could eat at home. But Lauren Bauer said there are holes in this safety net, particularly for parents who can't get to where schools are distributing their meals, perhaps because they have jobs as essential workers. There is also a gap for parents with children too young to attend school, the age at which poor nutrition can have lifelong consequences. Chloe Waterman said, and the government's main program to supposedly provide needy families with food, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, doesn't pay enough to live off, shifting the burden of surging unemployment onto charities. The effects have been felt by the non-profit organization Baltimore Hunger Project, which provides weekend groceries in and around the city of Baltimore for families whose children rely on school meals. The bag of eggs, bread, and other essentials Orellana picks up for her mother and herself, who are undocumented immigrants, and her two sisters, who were born in the United States, at a distribution in Coxville suburb, will last them about 2 weeks. She said, it's really hard sometimes, but you just got to keep going. Meanwhile, in Washington, the surge in hungry Americans comes amid a controversy over who Joe Biden, who projected by media as the next U.S. president, will pick as the U.S. Agriculture Secretary, a position that would oversee SNAP, that is, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and other nutrition programs. Heidi Heitkamp, a former North Dakota senator, is seen supposedly as a favorite for the position, but progressive groups and unions say she's too close to major oil and agricultural companies. They have pushed for Joe Biden to appoint House Representative Marcia Fudge, who has advocated for expanding SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Chloe Waterman claimed, Marcia Fudge recognizes that we need food access coupled with food equality. She added, reversing the rise in hunger could be done by expanding SNAP payouts and eligibility. That could bring relief to the Baltimore Hunger Project, which has seen demand triple to more than 2,000 families since the coronavirus pandemic struck. Ayo Akinremi, an immigrant from Nigeria who started picking up groceries for his wife and children after losing his job and now volunteers with the group, says, it breaks my heart, he added. It was a culture shock for me to come to the United States to find so much food insecurity.
This is for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life. Here on IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi. We were talking in the previous program about arrogance and that we should not have arrogance within us as a believer. Let me tell you a story about a doctor who accidentally killed his own son. A doctor is able to benefit from what he has learned of his knowledge, as long as it remains in his memory. But what would happen if Allah didn't want it to remain in his memory? For some people, knowledge is considered to be a reason to feel arrogance towards others. And you might wake up one day and you have forgotten everything, all your knowledge. And the same goes for our story here. The son of a doctor around 30 years ago had a fever, and the doctor thought that his son had malaria. The doctor treated him as if he had malaria, when in reality he had another kind of fever. The medication of that kind of fever and malaria are different. The son died after a few days. There is nobody who would work harder in finding a cure for that child other than his own father, that had all that knowledge. He had accumulated all of that knowledge, but all of that accumulated knowledge could not help him. Why? Because everything is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There was a religious doctor who passed away, and he told Shaheed Dastaghaib, Ayatollah Dastaghaib, rahmatullah alayh, "Sometimes I give someone medication which I am certain will work. Later I see that it did not have a positive effect. Sometimes medication that I thought might work works perfectly. It is clear that the effect is also from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." So whenever we take medicine, whenever we take a tablet, do remember to say Bismillah, in the name of Allah, because it is not sure that that will work either. You trust in Allah and you take that medicine. A doctor, like a religious scholar, is in need of his knowledge, and for that reason, he should not become arrogant. Everyone can do mistakes, no matter how much knowledge you have accumulated. So do not feel arrogance. A scholar must be humble. A believer must be humble. That is the moral trait of the prophets. A scholar, a doctor, a student, anyone who is a believer, an engineer, an architect, an IT engineer, every one of us must be humble. We should not consider ourselves to be different from the layman or from others, like was a millionaire. A billionaire must not consider himself different from a poor person. The $1 million that one has did not make him a person without needs. Can one's money cure him from an incurable disease? No, most surely that cannot. It should not be left unsaid that this is related to the person himself. The person should not consider himself high and others low. He should not have huge expectations of respect, but it is other people's duty to respect him and have him in a high esteem and hold him high.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
a scholar in any field must be respected. But that is from our side, and that person himself or herself should not seek that respect. Many traditions have been mentioned about this. For example, respecting a religious scholar is like respecting the messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Or respecting any scholar in any field, any expert in any field is respecting the messenger of Allah. But most surely, scholar of the religion is more so. So when you have this accumulated knowledge, do not feel arrogant. Do not feel that I am better than that person X because I know this technical terminology, or I work in that place. I'm not a sweeper, but maybe in front of Allah's eyes, that sweeper in the sight of Allah is dearer than we who are a CEO of a billion-dollar corporation. And we are, I don't know, engineers, and we are architects and IT experts. Maybe that sweeper, that shoemaker, is more dearer in the sight of Allah than the rest of us. So please, whenever we feel arrogance, try to battle the arrogance. And how do you battle the arrogance? You do good towards that person which you feel envy. You give him gifts. You use good language. You try to be at his service. You crush your carnal soul. You make yourself humble in front of that person X. Whenever you feel arrogance or envy, because they go hand in hand with each other. So try to do these technical applications. Do good towards the person you feel envy or arrogance at, and you will see that that arrogance will be crushed. That envy will be crushed beneath your feet. And as long as you feel that this arrogance has not been wiped out, you continue with the same techniques. Do good to the shoemaker, do good to the sweeper, do good to the nurse, and other occupations that are considered low according to the society that we live in. No job is low as long as it is a halal job. As long as you are earning halal money, there is no job which is low in the sight of Allah, even if the society says that. So do recall the virtues of the Prophet. Do recall the personality of the Prophets in these occasions. Whenever you feel arrogance coming within you, one must understand what arrogance is and where it comes from. Then he or she will realize how great a sin it is and how it could take us towards destruction. Arrogance is a state of feeling important, feeling that one has a special place. Reality is taken from him, and he only uses his imagination. Everyone in reality is nothing. Everybody is from dirt and will return to dirt. Oneself is also in real need. His life, health, and property are not in his hands. The commander of the faithful Ali alayhi salam says in one of his speeches found in Nahjul Balagha, the peak of eloquence, O creatures of Allah, Allah created you without you having a choice and takes care of you for as long as you are alive. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
All I need.
It's all I need.
All I need.
All I need.
Oh, oh,
your love is all I need. To be all I need. And I know that you see how much you need to me. Your love is all I need. To be all.
your love is all I need.
In the limelight.
The Biden-Harris administration is building an experienced criminal team by nominating for some top policy posts as well, including Secretary of State, Secretary of Homeland Security, National Security Advisor, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, among others. This will surely help extend America's interventionist policies in Muslim heartlands through diplomatic channels. This is not about looking to enter a new era of U.S. foreign policy, but rather trying to step back into the pre-Trump world. This is while America's endless war is pretty much universally recognized as the worst foreign policy blunder in its 21st century history. Yet now, Biden wants to reward them for it. He says, no retreat from Clinton, Bush, and Obama years here. And all this and more are bad news not only for the war-stricken people of the West Asia region, but Palestine and elsewhere. The Biden administration will definitely move to suppress Palestinian rights as well, even the BDS campaign, a peaceful protest movement protected by the UN Charter. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Fars News Agency, which is published under the heading, "The Empire of Chaos is Back Under Biden." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Joe Biden has announced infamous nominees for his national security and foreign policy team. He says America is back and ready to lead the world. The former vice president's comments are an apparent reflection of what the world community should expect under his foreign policy mandate, because his team reflects the fact that America is once again ready to mess with the world for all the wrong reasons. Under the circumstances, expect Biden to not retreat from America's endless wars. It will also sit once again at the head of the United Nations Security Council table, releasing sanctions resolutions to confront sovereign nations with much-needed help from Western allies, ready to stand up for the bogus war on terror et al. To this end, he has picked Antony Blinken, a former Obama administration official and longtime Biden aide, who has a history of pushing for U.S. wars and military interventions in places like Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Libya. The idea is to rebuild trust in the war state and bogus alliances. He has also picked Avril Haines to be his Director of National Intelligence, who served as both the Deputy Director of the CIA and the Deputy National Security Advisor under Obama. Haines has a racist history of running cover for CIA torture programs and served under former CIA Chief John Brennan when the Obama administration criminally increased drone strikes in places like Iraq, Pakistan, Yemen, and North Africa. He also helped crush anti-racism protests at home. No wonder human rights groups and peace activists have sounded the alarm over Biden's picks. These are the same criminals that launched endless wars against dozens of Muslim states in the West Asia region and played key roles in drone strike policy during Barack Obama's presidency. These are also the same goons that covered up the torture perpetrated by members of George W. Bush administration. Biden says preparations for more of the same are expected to follow. The Biden-Harris administration is building an experienced criminal team by nominating for some top policy posts as well, including Secretary of State, Secretary of Homeland Security, National Security Advisor, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, among others. This will surely help extend America's interventionist policies in Muslim heartlands through diplomatic channels. This is not about looking to enter a new era of U.S. foreign policy, but rather trying to step back into pre-Trump world. This is while America's endless war is pretty much universally recognized as the worst foreign policy blunder in its 21st century history. Yet now Biden wants to reward them for it. He says no retreat from the Clinton, Bush, and Obama years here. All this and more are bad news not only for the war-stricken people of the West Asia region, but Palestine and elsewhere. The Biden administration will definitely move to suppress Palestinian rights as well, even the BDS campaign, a peaceful protest movement protected by the UN Charter. He won't change course from Trump's State Department policies in his respect. Quite the opposite. The ex-Obama administration staffers will target and suppress support of Palestinian human rights everywhere, even at the UN. It is going to be pretty much business as usual for other nations as well, meaning huge war spending, a heavy U.S. footprint in the world, and this outdated notion that the U.S. should be at the head of the table when it comes to human rights and international human law. The ex-Obama administration staffers will create legal justification for Biden's drone wars and support for further blockades on Yemen, Syria, and Gaza. At the same time, leading human rights groups and the UN Human Rights Watch speak out fervently against these criminal policies, but to no avail. There is a saying in Washington that personnel is policy. As things stand, the ex-Obama administration staffers or Biden's group of national security pigs are all war criminals and should be held to account at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The world will not sleep easier until they are brought to justice. They are not picked to end America's endless wars. And certainly, this is unfortunate news for many war-stricken countries in the West Asia region. They are in no way picked to undo Trump's damage or Obama's damage. And certainly, they cannot build a more compassionate and common-sense foreign policy agenda for the United States of America. Put simply, they are excellent choices to help extend the destructive reach of the empire of chaos on this planet of ours. What else do you expect from a former vice president that backed the illegal wars on Iraq and Syria and drone bombing campaigns in countries like Pakistan and Yemen? This is also the same politician that, in 1990s, co-sponsored a bill with John McCain to send troops into Yugoslavia and later advocated a troop surge in Afghanistan and aerial warfare in Syria and Yemen. He's now telling us that the U.S. must take the same devastating lead in the policing the world. The strategy of global military domination with help from his scandalous circles.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, how to utilize your life effectively. Brothers and sisters, we said that life is precious and time management is very precious as well. How can you best utilize your time? Number one, connecting with Allah. Number two, ignoring time wasters. Number three, planning appropriately. Number four, subscribing to a not-to-do list. Next one, avoiding procrastination. Next one, remembering your time is limited. Last but not the least, sticking to a schedule. Well, today we're going to discuss the third one, which is planning appropriately. We need to organize our lives as Muslims. Our life is a trust from Allah and it has a timeline. Hence, the need for daily, weekly, monthly, and yearly plans is inevitable. We plan in awe of a bright future, hoping Allah spares our lives for good. So set high standards for yourself. Keep your eyes focused on your goals and see the big picture. Trust Allah's decision. But put in time and effort to achieve what you plan. Sometimes we trust Allah, or we think, or we feel that we trust Allah, we rely on Allah, and we are dependent on Allah, but the necessary and essential effort and scheduling and planning is absent in our calculations. So what ends up happening? We don't get the desired result, and then we, in our hearts sometimes, and sometimes openly, start blaming Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Well, guess what? The shortcoming was not from Allah's side. You were missing out on planning appropriately. You did not manage time. You did not put in the required effort. It is not Allah, but you who are to be blamed. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we're discussing how to utilize your life effectively. And we said time management is a crucial and essential piece of it. Now, we discussed three of the tips that we've been trying to give you to be able to manage your life better. And today we are going to talk about another one of them, and that is subscribing to a not-to-do list. You know how a to-do list is a very useful tool for highly productive people, right? In the times we live now, a not-to-do list is more important in order to avert distractions. It is as simple as spelling out the things that are not productive and finding a means to do away with them. On the other hand, prioritizing is necessary in order to get things done and produce meaningful results. So make sure that you have a to-do list in your life that is going to allow you to manage your affairs, day-to-day affairs, effectively and productively. And, you know, you're not going to forget things easily because now you've written them down. Now, not to-do list is more important, brothers and sisters, right? Because these not to-do lists, what they do is they would keep you from falling to those items which are going to be a hindrance in you getting to your to-do list. So if you want to go to and perform your to-do list, this not to-do list is actually a complementary and supplementary and supportive list. Sometimes, you know, we have seen, just to give you an example, we're playing video game and then it's namaz time. We know that namaz is on our to-do list, right? But because of this video game, we are so absorbed into it that the namaz time comes and namaz time passes by and we're still engaged with this video game. Now imagine if you had it on your not to do list. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
With the coronavirus pandemic surging and initial vaccine supplies limited, the United States faces a hard choice. Should the country's immunization program focus in the early months on the elderly and people with serious medical conditions who are dying of the coronavirus at the highest rates, or on essential workers, an expansive category encompassing Americans who have borne the greatest risk of coronavirus infection? The article you're about to hear has been written by journalists Abby Goodenough and Jan Hoffman, writing for the New York Times. The piece is titled, "The Elderly versus Essential Workers, Who Should Get the Coronavirus Vaccine First?" Stay with us for more of Abby Goodenough and Jan Hoffman's article. Coronavirus pandemic surging and initial vaccine supplies limited, the United States faces a hard choice. Should the country's immunization program focus in the early months on the elderly and people with serious medical conditions who are dying of the virus at the highest rates, or on essential workers, an expansive category encompassing Americans who have borne the greatest risk of coronavirus infection? Healthcare workers and the frailest of the elderly, residents of long-term care facilities, will almost certainly get the first shots of the vaccine under guidelines from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, the guidelines issued on Thursday. But with vaccination expected to start this month, the debate among federal and state health officials about who goes next and lobbying from outside groups to be included is growing more urgent. It's a question increasingly guided by concerns over the inequities laid bare by the pandemic, from disproportionately high rates of infection and death among poor people and people of color, to disparate access to testing childcare and technology for online schooling. It's a damnable that we are even being placed in this position, that we have to make these choices, said Reverend William J. Barber II, a co-chairman of the Poor People's Campaign, a national coalition that calls attention to the challenges of the working poor. But if we have to make the choice, we cannot once again leave poor people and low-wealth essential workers to be last. Ultimately, the choice comes down to whether preventing death or curbing the spread of the coronavirus and returning to some semblance of normalcy is the highest priority. If your goal is to maximize the preservation of human life, then you would bias the vaccine towards older Americans, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former Food and Drug Administration FDA commissioner, said recently. Dr. Scott Gottlieb added, if your goal is to reduce the rate of coronavirus infection, then you would prioritize essential workers. So it depends what impact you're trying to achieve. The trade-off between the two is muddied by the fact that the definition of essential workers used by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, comprises nearly 70% of the American workforce, sweeping in not just grocery store clerks and emergency responders, but also tugboat operators and nuclear energy workers. Some labor economists and public health officials consider the category overboard and say it should be narrowed to only those who interact in person with the public. About 70% of workers in the U.S. have jobs that are considered essential. A subset are considered frontline workers, meaning their jobs cannot be performed from home. An independent committee of medical experts that advises the CDC on immunization practices will soon vote on whom to recommend for the second phase of vaccination, Phase 1B. In a meeting last month, all voting members of the committee indicated support for putting essential workers ahead of people over the age of 65 and older, and those with higher risk health conditions. An independent committee of medical experts that advises the Center for Disease Control and Prevention on immunization practices will soon vote on whom to recommend for the second phase of vaccination. Historically, the committee relied on scientific evidence to inform its decisions, but now the members are weighing social justice concerns as well. According to Lisa Posser, a professor of health policy and decision sciences at the University of Michigan. Dr. Lisa Posser says, to me, the issue of ethics is very significant, very important for this country. Dr. Peter Zilagli, a committee member and a pediatrics professor at the University of California in Los Angeles, says at the time, clearly this favors the essential workers group because of the high proportion of minority, low-income and low-education workers among essential workers. That position runs counter to the framework proposed by the World Health Organization, WHO, the National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine, and many countries which say that reducing deaths should be the unequivocal priority, and that older and sicker people should thus go before the workers, a view shared by many in the public health and medicine industry. Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and the nation's top public health official, reminded the advisory committee of the importance of older people, saying in a statement on Thursday that he looked forward to future recommendations that, based on vaccine availability, demonstrate that we as a nation also prioritize the elderly. Once the committee votes, Dr. Robert Redfield will decide whether to accept its recommendations as the official guidance of the agency. Only rarely does the CDC director reject a recommendation from the committee, whose 14 members are selected by the Health and Human Services Secretary, serve 4.5-year terms, and have never confronted a task as high in profile as this one. But ultimately, The decision will be up to governors and state and local officials, health officials. They are not required to follow the CDC guidelines, though historically they have done so in the past.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The World with Reporters.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested Eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute. But ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbour, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal, as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal, as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The administration of US President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led US Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record. The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in a brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini Port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers.
The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Humayun Abedi, Tehran.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling